Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast series on the New Books Network. This podcast is for people who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean and learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me today. I'm your host, Ahmed Al-Mazmi from Princeton University. Today I'm here to talk to Professor Alexis Wick, the author of The Red Sea, In Search of Lost Space, published by University of California Press in 2016. Alexis Wick is Associate Professor of History at the American University of Beirut. By discussing this book, we will explore the Red Sea, which has, from time immemorial, been one of the world's most navigated spaces in the pursuit of trade, pilgrimage, and conquest. This book brings alive a dynamic Red Sea world across time, revealing the particular features of a unique historical actor in the Ottoman Empire and the Indian Ocean world. In capturing this heretofore lost space, it also presents a critical conceptual history of the sea, leading the reader into the heart of Eurocentrism. The sea, it is shown, is a vital element of the modern philosophy of history. Welcome, Ali, to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk about your book today.
Thank you for the invitation. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you. Would you like to say a few words about yourself? That is, where you grew up, where you went to school, how you became interested in Ottoman history in the Indian Ocean world and the Red Sea, and if you had any influences, mentors along the way.
Sure. And indeed, in many ways, although this is a very academic book, obviously, it also, I realized subsequently, was also a very personal story. I grew up in Palestine, a land, as you know, which is slotted between the Eastern Mediterranean and the Red Sea, and I went to both of these seas very much and very often. In my youth. Then I eventually left and studied in the United States for my undergraduate studies, then some time in France, and finally I moved to New York and Columbia University for my PhD studies. As an undergraduate already, I majored in history, writing a thesis on Palestine. And then I did a degree also in Paris in African history. And but of course, most influential, no doubt, was my graduate curriculum at Columbia University, where I eventually settled on an Ottoman. Specialization, and was led to study the history of the sea and the Red Sea in particular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how did the book idea develop? If you can share with us the research process, the writing experience.
This is something I talk about quite candidly, actually, in the book itself. Like many others, I was really attracted to the potential of the sea or sea-centered history to offer new paths for historical research. This was, I was not alone in this. In the early 2000s, this was a very fashionable, let's say, approach. The idea that maritime history and sea-centered histories could offer something new and innovative and different from other types of history. Of course, Mediterraneanist historians were trailblazers, but scholars of other regions and other seas had also followed suit. Many different seas had gotten their histories written and had their historians, except for the Red Sea. And yet it seemed to me that the Red Sea presented itself as an ideal historical subject and a subject of history in the full sense. So I went to the Ottoman archives, having trained as an Ottomanist. I went to the Ottoman archives with the idea of writing a holistic account of the Red Sea in the manner of the great French historian of the Mediterranean, Fernand Braudel. But it was during the research and then the writing that the project was transformed beyond recognition in many ways, and that the book eventually took the form and the appearance that it does now. Simply put, what I discovered in the Ottoman archives, first and foremost, is that the Ottomans did not call this space the Red Sea, not until the mid-19th century, that is. And indeed, that they did not conceive of that space as a coherent, constituted region, as we think of it now as a sea. And so the challenge then for me was how to think through that discovery genuinely and think through it.
Mm-hmm. And in the book, you unpack that more in the introduction, History at Sea, Space, and the Other. In the introduction, you really push the reader to think about the analytical possibilities of the Red Sea. So if you can elaborate on these possibilities to think about space and the making of historical and scientific objects, why is it important to pose this question?
My contention, I guess, is that maritime history and the history of the Ottoman Red Sea is relevant to more than a small subfield of a specialist historical writing. You know, indeed, what I'm putting forward is that this absence of the Red Sea that I had, that gap in the historical literature, is not innocent. The gap that I sought to just fill with the proper historical account of the Red Sea is not actually innocent, but tells us something more profound about the historical discipline more largely. And through the Red Sea and a reflection on the Red Sea in the Ottoman period, one actually reaches central questions of the discipline more largely, and philosophy of history and other disciplines, in fact, too. So why should the Ottoman Red Sea be of interest beyond a narrow subfield? Or it's what I'm submitting to the readers is that it forces us to think about space and how space interacts, and of course geography impacts and interacts with history. And my point of departure is to echo the French philosopher Merleau-Ponty, that space is not, quote, the setting, real or imagined, in which things are arranged, but the means whereby the positing of things becomes possible. And so I think the research that I ended up doing posed the question of space and history, which spaces become historical and which don't.
Over the next five chapters in the book, we encounter the Red Sea from different dimensions. In the first chapter, The Place in the Middle, a Geohistory of the Red Sea. In this chapter, you write the Red Sea into history through a Brudelian approach. What are the potentials and limitations of this approach? What are some of the human and non-human forces that shape the history of this body of water over time?
That's a difficult question and quite a large one.
Well, if you think of salient features.
Yes, let me begin with the limitations, I guess, of the approach, perhaps. Let me formulate it differently, the dangers of the approach as I see them. And these limitations or dangers are quite simply the imposition of a reified and essentialized spatial unit onto historical dynamics that are much more diverse and complicated. So the most obvious symptom of what I'm talking about here, of this reification, would be geographical determinism, or determinism more largely, the idea that geography and the environment wholly determine the historical process under study. And this, I think, there is some danger in a Brodelian or a geohistorical approach to push too much in that direction. That said, it also, as you might presume, I think it also has great potential. And this is something that others also have often argued. Many in the field of thalassology, this oceanic turn in the discipline, it has the potential of thinking beyond the state, beyond anachronistic political or cultural boundaries. It also offers the potential of thinking outside of the anthropocentric bias of conventional history. In this sense, geography, geology, fauna, flora, all of these climate, all of these dimensions end up playing as important a role as the more conventional domains of historical inquiry, military, diplomacy, economy, etc. And I think that actually offers great, of course, potential to disrupt the presentist assumptions that we tend to take for granted. the nation state being an obvious example. As for the salient features of the Red Sea, there are many. It's a really quite extraordinary space in and of itself, in fact. But I would outline two clusters. One is that it's a peculiar and exceptional space because it contains in its very being, let's say, a startling paradox. It is very inhospitable to human settlement because of various geological and geographical and climatic reasons, and yet it had to be populated, including with significant cities and towns. It was, and so that's a paradox that it struggles with throughout in the longue durée. It was very difficult to navigate, and yet for a number of reasons, it had to be sailed constantly. Again, a difficult paradox that it struggled with throughout. It was in absolute need of boats for that navigation, and yet it has very few sources of timber and wood. So I think in that sense, it's a really exceptional and quite interesting space in and of itself. The other cluster of features that I would highlight is what one historian has described as the triple cosmic metronome that governs its movement across time, let's say. One followed the sun and agricultural cycles and trade, therefore, across the seas according to agricultural cycles. Another cyclical rhythm that governed movement in the area was the wind regimes that facilitated navigation in the sea, and notably, of course, the southern in the southern part of the sea, the monsoon winds that attached the southern Red Sea to the western Indian Ocean and navigation in the Indian Ocean more largely. And finally, of course, the presence of the Haramain, the holy cities, if you like, of Islam, and the yearly metronome of the pilgrimage, which is, of course, incumbent on any able Muslim, which defined that area and that space quite markedly.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for offering this beautiful overview of the Red Sea. In the second chapter, we move into the historical times, and you take onto two targets. In the chapter, Philosology alla Turca, Sixth Thesis on the Philosophy of History, what are some of the historiographical interventions that this chapter achieves in critiquing Ottoman historiography and philosophy of Oceanic history?
Well, without getting into too many details, this is the chapter precisely that explores the question that I evoked a little earlier, which is the following. Is the absence of the Red Sea from historical attention as an integrated subject innocent or coincidental, in a sense, accidental? Or does this gap, does this absence reveal a set of deeply embedded assumptions in our craft, in the way we write history, and Ottoman history in particular, that prevented the very idea of a history of the Red Sea from emerging? And in this chapter, I outline six broad clusters that seek to show that indeed this absence of the Red Sea, despite its obvious candidacy as a historical actor, was not accidental, but was due to historiographical and methodological features of the discipline. One of them, for example, and it goes from the macro, let's say, to the micro. One of them being this assumption, this long-standing assumption of that associates Europe with the sea and maritimity, and by contrast, Islam more largely, and the Ottoman Empire in particular, with landedness, indeed with the desert in the more crude versions. Another obstacle to the historical becoming of the Red Sea is this paradigm of provisionism that has dominated Ottoman historiography. The idea that the Ottoman state was simply obsessed with provisioning the army and the capital city above all other activities. Another feature, for example, is the opposition between the Arab and the African, which I think has been nefarious to thinking of the Red Sea as a coherent whole. Since it is seen as splitting an Arab world from an African world. And it's these types of questions that I get through in six clusters in total in the chapter.
Mm-hmm. And I find that's very useful. To integrate Ottoman historiography into the Indian Ocean by problematizing these relationships. Uh-huh. In chapter 3, Self-Portrait of the Ottoman Red Sea, June 21st, 1777, you take on an interesting historical exercise. Can you tell us about the document that you analyze in this chapter, in an exegesis, as you call it? What does it tell us about how the Ottomans conceptualize this maritime space? What are some of the, as you call it, various spatialities and temporalities embedded in the content and form of that document?
Well, the document itself is in fact an entry, like all the others, in a quite famous and much used collection of documents in the Ottoman archives, the Muhime i Misr registers. It is from the ninth volume of that series. And the series basically is a collection of that gathered documents or information of the important affairs relating to the province of Egypt writ large, including mainly commands or copies, of course, of commands sent from Istanbul to administrators in the region. And it's in a way, quite trivial document by an unnamed scribe buried in one of the volumes of these numerous defters in the Ottoman archives. My challenge in that chapter can we attempt to write a history outside of the hegemonic weight of Eurocentric space and time? In other words, if the Ottomans did not speak of the Red Sea as the Red Sea, if they did not conceive of the space as a coherent whole, how can we write a history of the Ottoman Red Sea, taking Ottoman documents seriously in their plenitude, not simply as a mine of data? And my methodological suggestion is that is one that others have pioneered, a method of overreading or slow reading or deep reading. And my argument is that we should practice this form of reading even on the most trivial documents, not merely on the great canons of high culture, but also a short entry, a fairly short entry in a common register of Ottoman documents can contain, if we read it sympathetically enough and closely enough, contains an entire universe in itself. And so the entry, in fact, consists of essentially an order on the part of Istanbul for the Egyptian, the administrators in Cairo to purchase ships at Suez in order to replace ships that had been destroyed and that belonged to a waqf, a charitable endowment, which was dedicated to provisioning the Hejaz with foodstuffs and sustaining the population of the Hejaz in the name of the Ottoman elite and Ottoman sultans and whatnot. But what I was struck by as I'm reading the document is how verbose and longer it was than the order, the command in itself warranted. The command could have been, you know, written in two sentences. Instead, it goes into a deep elaboration in order to formulate this command fully. And through a close reading of this entry, I seek to reveal how that space, which we call the Red Sea, but which was not thought of as such at the time, how that space was conjured in the writings of the Ottoman elites between Istanbul and Cairo. And in that writing appears a whole range of temporalities from the kind of long time of natural causes that evoke, for example, the difficulty of navigation on the sea between Suez and Jeddah, but also the long time and the necessity, almost supernatural or at least divinely inspired necessity to sustain the population of the Hejaz that was such a great source of legitimacy for the Ottoman government and the Ottoman Sultan. But also specialities expand like an accordion through the reading, bringing in wider spaces, notably in the Indian Ocean, but also the Eastern Mediterranean and beyond in a variety of ways. Does that make sense?
Yes, I find this very enjoyable chapter, to be honest. And I find it really useful for anyone who would want to engage with such a reading. You follow up that by venturing into the colonial age, the age of high imperialism, in chapter 4, the scientific invention of the Red Sea. How was the Red Sea produced as a scientific object in the 19th century? And what are the ramifications of that process?
That's a good question and a difficult one again. In short, which I seek to explore in depth in that chapter, the short answer is, what you evoked in your question, the age of imperialism and a new form of imperial encounter. And it involved, in the case of the Red Sea, and indeed elsewhere, it was part of a wider story of the expansion of British power in the region and indeed across the globe. But in the Mediterranean in particular, in the Ottoman Empire, and of course, most importantly, for the British, no doubt, in India and the Indian Ocean. And my argument is that the Red Sea was captured textually even before any of its shores were subjected to any form of colonial control. Although, of course, this is placed in the context of the rivalry between France and Britain in the region following the French conquest of Egypt in 1798, of course. But the basic argument is that the Red Sea was turned into a scripted and legible space in the first half of the 19th century. And this transformation was indeed very explicitly seen as a precursor or a facilitator to the spread of British commercial and military and colonial power in the region. Indeed, and crucial to this story, of course, is that it was this new formulation of space and of the Red Sea as a discrete space was articulated and couched in the language of science and of objectivity. And indeed, what is hailed as the first systematic scientific charting of the Red Sea, Moresby and Elwan's sailing directions for the Red Sea, which I also subject to a close reading in that chapter, preceded the British occupation of Aden by just a few years. And I think that's not accidental at all. The ramifications you asked about are extensive, and we could discuss these at multiple levels. But simply to give you a sense of things, it is in this period or in the wake of this process that the Ottomans that the category the Red Sea, Bahri Ahmer or Kizil Deniz or Al Bahr Al Ahmar, emerges in Ottoman and Arabic discourse. It had been practically non-existent before. There were other names, of course, which I explore in the book. Bahri Suez was the most common appellation in Ottoman, but there were others, many others, and that's part of the argument. In the mid-19th century, after this wider transformation, the Ottomans and others around the shores begin using the category the Red Sea and begin thinking about that space as a coherent whole.
Mm-hmm. And this is really adds to the literature on colonial knowledge production and the process of colonization. And most of that has been done on land, but you've taken that to the sea. And then the last chapter, you call it Thalassomnia, Modernity and the Sea. What do you mean by Thalassomnia, and what do we gain by genealogically tracing the seas and the oceans as analytical and spatial units? What are the ontological implications of your findings on the way different disciplines, and in particular history, conceptualize and write about these spatial units?
Mm. Thalassomnia is a reference to the unexpected centrality and importance, actually, that the sea and maritimity have in modern European philosophy of history. And this, in a way, is the primary discovery and revelation of this chapter. It shows, contrary to what is usually said about sea-centered histories and thalassology, that it is new, that it is recent, that it is politically neutral, etc. All of the potentialities that we discussed at the very beginning of our discussion here. In fact, this chapter shows that the legwork that went into the production of the sea as an important and coherent historical space came well before Fernand Braudel. Indeed, it traces this centrality of the sea well into the heart. Figures of European modern thought and philosophy of history mobilized the idea of the sea in their projects. And I'm speaking here of the most famous of these figures, Grotius, Adam Smith, Hegel, Ritter, and many others. And what it identifies, and I think this is where the stakes lie, perhaps most importantly, and what you evoke as the ontological implications of it all. What it shows is that there has been, from the early evocations of this question, an intimate identification of the sea with Europe, and essentially of this maritimity, this relationship to the sea as being peculiar to the European, and a key to understand the so-called European miracle or the European exceptionalism or European exceptionalism. And thus the implications of this research places, once again, returns the question of maritime history and the sea to the center of our craft and our discipline more largely, because of this crucial aspect of maritimity as an ingredient, as an essential ingredient in the ubiquitous Eurocentrism of the modern disciplines, including history and geography. And in more detail and more specifics, this involves obviously the colonial dimensions of modern thought more largely.
In your conclusion, you call it rigging the historian's craft for an epistemology of composition. I would like to ask you, it has been 40 years since your book was released, and you have received different feedbacks and reviews of it. How did you see the book's impact, and what sort of impact would you like it to have, let's say, on historians and other people engaged with the question of the sea?
In general, I guess, or in the most at the most abstract, I would hope that it pushes us to pay more attention to the words and the concepts that govern our craft and our writing, both in the sources that we use and in the compositions that come out of us. Of course, this is more specifically an intervention in a way in Ottoman history. And of course, I see it as being in specific conversation with a number of arguments in Ottomanist historiography. That said, it is also, or I see it as an intervention that is also a plea for Ottoman history to get out of its shell and engage in conversations with other fields and indeed other disciplines. So I hope that, you know, students and scholars of other areas and other approaches, the Indian Ocean, the Mediterranean, Africa, the history of science, history of colonialism, history of law, will find it engaging and enter in conversation with it.
Mm-hmm. The book is really of utility for a wider audience that wants to think about how do we constitute regions and what are the problematic in doing that kind of work. Well, we've taken a lot of your time, and as much as I would like this conversation to keep going, I would like to ask you, what are you working on now? Can you tell us about your current and future projects or what you hope to work on?
Sure. Well, I continue to be interested in the relationship between place and writing or thinking, between history and geography. I'm working on two different, but I think complementary projects that are both of which are in ways emerge from this research on the Red Sea. One is an exploration of the emergence of Europe as a geographical concept, seen in particular from its Ottoman and Mediterranean edges. Another parallel project concerns the emergence of the idea of the Arab world, and specifically Arab history as an autonomous and separate field of writing and research. And then there's other little things that I'm working on as well.
It seems that you are really into taking on these big questions. And I'm really looking forward to reading these works. Thank you for your time today. And thank you for listening to today's episode, in which we explored the Red Sea in Search of Lost Space, published by University of California Press in 2016. This is your host, Ahmed Mazmi. Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.